Welcome, everyone, to our second of our series on Megillat Rut, the Book of Ruth. So just to spend a few quick moments to do a short summary of last week. So we began this book, we said it was a testament written by Samuel, Shmuel HaNavi, and it testifies to the legitimacy of King David's genealogy. We said that in the future, the evil Doeg, the Edomite, would cast aspersions on David's legitimacy, not only to be the future king of the Jewish people, much to Saul's consternation, but even to be a member of the Jewish people. And this would testify that, yes, there was a problem, because the Torah says no Moabite should enter and marry a Jew, but that was limited in effect only to the males of Moab, but not to the females. This was reintroduced by Boaz, the hero of our story that we're going to meet in the second chapter next week. But that the story also is an amazing love story. In fact, something I did not mention last week, which my Rebbe likes to mention, just as kind of a joke, it's not meant to be a criticism of the great Art Scroll Corporation, but I read in one of the Art Scroll books on Megillat Rut, it goes to a great extent to try to prove that this is not a love story. Now, clearly Art Scroll is offended by the idea of sort of like the romance and the soap opera nature of, I guess, a portrayal that would be not in keeping with the text itself. So that's clearly what they're after. But when you read it, it seems to be saying that there is not an act of love. And this is the most marvelous love story, because it starts with a love story between Naomi and Ruth, as we're going to see tonight, that relationship, the love between these two amazing women. You're going to have an amazing love story, Boaz and Ruth. And it has to be a love story for the very simple reason that it creates a man whose name literally translated means Mr. Love, David. David means love. So only through this type of loving relationship could you hope to create the one who sets the stage for the home of God, the Beit HaMikdash, the temple in Jerusalem, David HaMelech, who does everything except for the implementation of the deed itself, which is given to Solomon, his son. So clearly it is a marvelous, marvelous love story. And really, the ultimate relationship of love is between Ruth and our Creator towards God, as we are going to see tonight. It's through the relationship of the two women, yes, but ultimately it is the love for our Creator, for God, that brings Ruth to our people. So we spoke last week about a famine in the land of Israel, and how Elimelech, the richest man in all the land, took his family against their will, ostensibly, left the land in its time of need. He could have single-handedly helped everyone in Bethlehem, Judah area, just by himself. He was the Parnes Hador, the one who had the capability to support, give Parnassah to the world. He chose to flee. Not only was his betrayal a betrayal of the people locally, but to go to the arch enemy Moab, who were the anti-Israel, because we defined Moab and the Torah's hatred of Moab. And the reason that they're not allowed to enter into this covenant of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob is because they refused kindness to the Jewish people. We offered money. Just give us a little food and drink on our way to Israel. They said, pass by. So because of this denial of common decency, of meshlichkeitness, they preclude themselves from being a part of our people. So this is the origin of this. So Elimelech goes to Moab with the intent to stay there for a little while. That little while, of course, goes on and on and on. And God punishes him. First, we said, God punishes the person's property. Wake up. Repent. No, you didn't get the message. Then maybe we'll punish you, the person. Disease, illness, that still doesn't get the message. Finally, Elimelech dies. Message received? No. Because his two sons, and we kind of made fun that their names literally translate, if you remember, Machlon, Kilion, Mr. Disease and Mr. Death, nice names for a Jewish parent to give to their child. Machlon and Kilion, they not only don't get the message and return immediately to the promised land, no, they don't. They take themselves Moabite princesses. Orpah is married to Kilion, and Ruth is married to Machlon. And we said, interestingly, that Machlon's name comes from disease, Machala, but it also has the connotation of Mechila, forgiveness, because ultimately there will be a redemption through the marriage what's called a Levirate marriage, Yibum, of Boaz and Ruth. And since Boaz is from his father Elimelech's family, the child that they will have will ultimately, quote-unquote, be credited to the dead Mahlon. So ultimately he dies, but it, in a sense, is redeemed from beyond the grave. Interesting. So 10 years pass. Once again, they're bereft of everything in this world except their lives, and then that happens. And Naomi's all alone. Now, the rabbis have a lot to say, like, why couldn't Mahlon and Kilion come back? Well, they put themselves in an untenable situation, because think about it. Once you marry princesses of Moab, you can't divorce them and live happily ever after in Moab. I mean, the kings of Moab are going to say, what, our young ladies, the best of the best, they're not good enough for you. You're going to divorce our daughters? Really? Really? So they couldn't do that. It was politically impossible for them. And to go back to Bethlehem, Judah, with Moabite princess wives, unconverted young ladies, they're going to be, whatever they do, they're going to be marginalized to the extreme. So they really were in an untenable situation. They died. Finally, Naomi is stripped of everything in her world. Her husband, Elimelech, her children, Mahlon and Kilion, her money, her pearls, her diamonds, it's all gone. Her health is ostensibly a little bit gone, as we're going to see tonight. But she says, now the time, as we're going to see tonight, the time is to come back. And Ruth and Orpah say, we're coming with you. Now, when they begin the journey, it is not at all clear to Naomi that her former daughters-in-law, Ruth and Orpah, are doing anything other than accompanying the old woman on a safe journey, as we'll see tonight. But then as the journey progresses, it becomes clear that their intent could be to return with her to Israel. And as we said, this is a big problem because, yes, it says in the Torah, no Moabite man. But the idea that even a woman from Moab could be off limits, it wasn't clear. The belief was, erroneously so, that even a woman was off limits. Not true. But it was a perception. As we know, perception becomes reality. So to go back to Bethlehem, Judah, as we're going to see tonight, which was a xenophobic place towards people who are of non-Moabite, non-alien tradition, they didn't like anybody. They didn't even like Jews from other tribes, as we're going to see. They're not very nice to Naomi upon her return. So to bring back Ruth and Orpah to come back home now with the aged Naomi is not a very viable future for the young ladies, as we'll see tonight. And the rabbis tell us that Ruth and Orpah and this little journey with Naomi, this little journey that only we're privy to, remember, because Samuel writes this almost as an addendum to the books of Judges and the book of Samuel itself, as almost a link in the chain between how you transition from the time of the judges to the time of the kings. This is right there because it's the creation of the kings of Israel. David, Solomon, the Davidic line is created right from this book. So it's a transitional, transformational story. Okay, so let's go back inside. We left off in verse 6, Pasuk Vav. So what happens after the death of Elimelech? So it says, Vatokam hi v'chaloseho. She, Naomi, whenever we use pronouns, we always like to fill them in, just for sake of clarity's purpose. Vatokam hi, she, Naomi, gets up, v'chaloseha, along with her former daughters-in-law. Vatoshav miste Moav, and she returns from the fields of Moav, even though we're going to see in the next verse that it didn't happen yet. Why did she return at this moment? Kishama biste Moav, because she heard a report in the fields of Moav. Maybe it was an instant message, a tweet, CNN, Canaan News Network, we're not sure. What was the report? Kifakot Hashem et Amo, that God had remembered divinely his nation of Israel, latet lahem lachem, to give them food. The famine was at an end. Now, how do we know? How do we know then that she didn't return yet? And I'm going to do the next verse, and then we're going to get to questions, and we're going to pick it apart, okay? So if she returned, then why does the next verse, verse 7, Zion say, so she returned from the place where she had been. Well, you already told us that she got up and left. Well, if she got up and left, why are you saying this again, redundantly? And secondly, why does it have to say that she went from the place where she was? What does that mean? She could go from the place where she wasn't? I mean, it's a little bit superfluous. Her two daughters-in-law were with her. They went on the road. They traveled on the road. Again, okay, but why mention the road? Just say they went. Lashu, to return El Eretz Yehuda, to the land of Judah. Jeff, you have a question, comment?
Well, how come it says daughter-in-law in the beginning of 6, and then it says daughters-in-law down below in 7.
Okay, let's look at 6.
Like she's just with one daughter-in-law and not both.
Okay, in 6 it says...
Unless that's just a translation.
It's an error, yeah, okay. Yeah, it's an error. Sorry.
That's okay.
Yeah. No worries. So let's dissect these two verses. Let's go back to number 6. So it said in number 6, then she arose along with her daughter-in-law, because I guess originally you could say that Ruth was the one who was the motivator here, and Orpah was along for the ride. That could be the simplest exclamation.
Why is she rising?
Ah, excellent.
I'm hearing rising.
Right. She gets up. Right, exactly. What does that mean?
Was she laying down?
Ah, excellent.
They say.
So I think I have an idea here. I think this is what's going on.
Husband?
I'm sorry?
Did she rise from mourning?
Yes. Thank you. Jeff got one of the explanations is she got up after the Shiva was over. Jeff, brilliant. You get up from Shiva. We use that as a metaphor. When a person rises after the 7 days of the mourning, we say you got up from Shiva. Very well said. Yeah, beautiful. So the Pashup Shot, the way to understand this verse that she rose is from mourning. But something else is going on here. Because why does it say twice, almost 3 times, that she rose and returned, but she hadn't gone anywhere? And then the next verse says she left. Well, if she left, then why does it have to say before that she already returned? So clearly, there's two components here. I'll use an analogy of a cult. Okay? Let's use a cultish analogy from the 60s. So let's say that this person goes and saves a young guy, young girl from a cult. So they're brainwashed, but at the point where they leave the cult, they have an epiphany. They wake up and they look around and say, oh my gosh, what am I doing in Guyana? This is Jim Jones, the Kool-Aid, what am I doing here, right? And you get up and you are blown away by your own illusory life that you were leading up to that point. So you resolve, you have a moment, you have an epiphany, we say, I am out of here. So I believe when it says vatokim, in addition to what Jeff was saying, that it means the end of the Shiva process, the mourning process. It's a wake-up call. She rose to get up, meaning there was an awakening within her soul to the reality, what in the world am I doing in Moab? I'm an alien here? What has happened to me and my family? I've lost everything, but look where I am. I'm out of here. I'm gone. I cannot tolerate one more second. And we all have experienced this, where sometimes you live in a certain dynamic. And the moment where you want to effect a change, what was tolerable even 10 seconds or a minute ago becomes absolutely intolerable. I'm gone. So I believe that the first verse is the resolve of Naomi to get out of there no matter what the cost, as we'll see in a minute. Whatever it costs, I'm done. I cannot remain here one more second. Oh, I was here for 10 plus years? Good. But at this moment, I'm a, that's the resolution. Batakam, she gets up to return. Okay? So let's read it again inside verse 6. Vatakam hi v'chalata, so she and her daughter-in-law Ruth, she rose from Shiva, she had the resolve, Vatoshav, even though she hadn't returned, she resolved to return from Steya Moav. I'm so out of here, mentally, if not physically yet. Ki shema v'steya Moav, so she heard in the fields of Moav. The rabbi says, well, how could she have heard? How did she hear that God had remembered the people of Israel to give them bread? So some say, you know, there were peddlers that would travel back and forth. And during the famine, there wasn't a lot of give and take between people traveling back selling their wares. Clearly, they are the ones who had the street know-how that would tell you what's going on. Well, now they heard, guess what? Word has spread. Famine's done. There's food to be bought. There's food to be sold. So the word was spread. And then it says in verse 7, number Zion, so she left from the place where she had been. That's a strange thing. We'll come back to that last. Vatelachna v'derech, and she traveled on the road. Well, hello, where else would she travel? Why not just say she went? Why does it say on the road? What do we care about the place that she traveled? It's a strange thing. Go back. So the rabbis say a couple of interesting ideas. Vatelachna v'derech, she went on the road. She literally went on the road. She was so poor at that moment. She didn't have shoes to wear. So she literally was walking barefoot, physically, on the road. Now, remember, it's not a paved four-lane highway coming back from Moab to Israel. So in other words, this works hand in hand with the explanation of a tokon that she rose. It's a result. She is so out of there that no matter what it would take, she had to walk barefoot. Okay, I'm out of Jonestown. I'm gone. I am coming home to my family, to my native land. Also, the implication, the rabbis say, is that she traveled on a time where it was inappropriate for her to travel, illegal by Torah law. It was Passover. She wasn't allowed to travel. It was actually the festival of Passover, the first day of Passover, Pesach. And you're not allowed to travel from one domain to another domain, let alone one country to another country. Halacha, Jewish law, forbids it. But teilachna has the same word as halacha. Halacha means to go, the way we travel in our lives, right? The same word. So she went at a time that it was inappropriate to go. But wait a minute, there's a rule called preservation of my life, called pikuach nefesh. And we all know that if, God forbid, somebody needs medical attention or anything on a Shabbat or a Yom Tov, what happens? We push away the laws. All the laws do not apply. You get in the car, you pick up the phone, you take whatever it takes to save a human life. Well, whose life was at risk here? Naomi. She felt that one more moment in this untenable, unlivable situation of Moab, spiritual destruction. So she literally traveled at a time that it was inappropriate. Others say, Batelachna Vaderf, she went on the road. As she was traveling with Ruth and Orpah, she's teaching them, as we said, Telachna Halacha. She's sort of, young ladies, I know that you're from Moab and you have very fancy schmancy genealogy from the big fat King Eglon that we spoke about last week. But guess what? If you're coming back to Israel, you may want to know a couple facts about what it means to be Jewish. Maybe she was teaching them a little bit about matzah because it was Passover time. Whatever. She's teaching them laws, Jewish halacha. What do you do to somebody who potentially chooses to become Jewish, who converts? You start teaching them Jewish halacha, you teach them law. So Naomi, ostensibly, as they were traveling, was giving them Judaism 101, right? That's another implication. Okay, but what about the redundancy? Vateitse min hamakom. She left the place. When the previous verse already told us, she got up and left. Ah, this is beautiful. Rabbi Shlomo Yitzchaki, Rashi, plagiarizes, of all people, himself. So I guess it was okay. He literally, word for word, plagiarizes himself in a very profound way. There is a parsha way, way back in Genesis called Vayetze. It says, Vayetze Yaakov mi Be'er Sheva. Jacob left home, Beersheba, to go to Haran, and that's when he spent 20 years with evil Uncle Lavan, getting all the girls and the 12 tribes of Israel. Okay? So the rabbis famously asked, meaning Rashi, wait a minute. Why does it tell us both the destination and the point of origin? We knew he was in Beersheba. Why does it say that he left Beersheba? Rashi says, because when he left Beersheba, it's telling you that the property, the values of Beersheba's properties crashed, plummeted through the floor. Because as long as Jacob's in town, he was the light of the city. He was the joy. He was the most magnificent human being in Beersheba. When he leaves town, it was all gone. Property values, for sale signs everywhere. Exact same thing happens here. Naomi, Ruth, and Orpah, when they leave the fields of Moab, the Moabites are looking around going, wait a minute. Whoa, whoa, whoa. What happened here? Why am I here if they're not here? It's no fun. Now, we've all had experiences like this. And Rashi says it's such a beautiful idea. What do we know about Naomi at this moment? Nothing. I mean, nothing, literally. We know a little bit about her husband, Elimelech, that he was rich, and he was the guy who thought, Eli HaMelech, I'll be the guy, the king comes. That's a little bit of a delusional self-aggrandizer. But we don't know about Naomi. I mean, we don't even know, did she make a good chalat in Shabbos? We know nothing, right? Nothing. Rashi says, yeah, you do. This is all you have to know. You see, in Jacob's case, when he left town, we know a whole lot about Jacob when he leaves Beersheba. We know years of his life. We know what a great person he was, and he was a Torah scholar, and how he honored his mom and his dad, everything, right? But Naomi, we know nothing. So Rashi, I believe, this is my Rebbe, is coming here, in the case of Naomi, to actually not only tell us about Naomi's greatness, but then in retrospect, we can look back and apply the same logic to Jacob. When Jacob left town, it wasn't that he was a Torah scholar. Of course he was. And it wasn't that he was, you know, a brilliant human being. Yes, he was. And it wasn't that he did all these wonderful mitzvot for everyone, precepts and help people. Of course he did. That's not what made Jacob special. What makes Jacob special is the same thing that makes Naomi special. And we've all had this experience in our lives. Think about it. You've probably been touched by people in your lives. And you weren't even aware of it. Because I know I've had this experience. Just one or two people along the way. That when you're with them, everything's great. Everything's fun. But as soon as like they graduate or they move away, you look around and say, oh my gosh, you know, I used to love coming here. It's not fun anymore because that person's not there. I used to so much enjoy watching him, whether it was at synagogue or school, could be in high school, could be universities, my yeshiva. There were just the one or two people who were just their shining souls. There was so much geschmack, you know, they had so much life. And they gave you energy and they gave you a sense of purpose. And that's what Rashi is saying. That all you have to know about Naomi is that when she left the fields of Moab, the Moabites didn't even realize how great she was. But when she departed, they looked around and said, oh my gosh, what are we doing here if she's gone? Then they felt her impact. That's what Rashi says. Yitzias tzadik min hamakom, nasa rosham. That the departure of a righteous individual, a great individual, a shining light, when he or she leaves town, the impact is felt. So when Jacob left town, oh boy, in Beersheba they felt it. In Moab even, the corrupt Moab, they looked around and said, oh my gosh, no more Naomi, no more Ruth, no more Orpah. What's going on? How are we going to live like this? And I think it's a very sobering lesson because it means we should take stock of those in our lives that we love and our friends that we love and why we love them. You know, in other words, don't take it for granted that they're always going to be with us because maybe, you know, people do move on, especially in our society today. And so when they're here, if we would just take stock of how special they are and not always be looking down the road, just take a deep breath and take stock of who we are. And that when they depart, it won't be a departure that is only felt in retrospect. You'll enjoy them on the journey. And I think it's a very powerful idea that Rashi brings about Naomi. She was just a marvelous, shining soul. As we're going to learn a little bit more about her now on their amazing journey. Okay, let's go back inside. Pasuk Chet, number 8. So at this point, Naomi now picks up on the intent of Ruth and Orpah to come with her all the way. Not just, let's go with the old lady until the point of the border. No. They're actually going to go back to Israel. So she, and this is the basis for Jewish law, begins a process of trying to dissuade the two of them to not come. You may have heard this before, that when someone who's interested in becoming Jewish first approaches the rabbi, we have three times that we're supposed to sort of dissuade them, say, look, why are you choosing this? Choose something else, you know. For example, do you know that we have 613 laws, and right now you have 7? And if you keep those 7, they're called the Noahide commandments, you get to go to heaven. But if you take 606 more, by the way, Ruth's name in Gematria, numerology, can you guess what it is? 606. Because she's the paradigm for someone who takes the extra 606 willingly, right? Most of us do it because it's foisted on us, right? To do it willingly, to know, oh my gosh, if I have 613, there's a much greater chance that I will fail at that task. 7 is a whole lot easier to keep and be a good person and get to go to heaven. Remember, we're not like other religions. We don't believe that we have a monopoly on heaven. You get a person who's a righteous person, keeps those 7, and the 7, by the way, are like the big ones. You would not want to associate probably with somebody who doesn't keep those 7, you know, because it's murder and, you know, idolatry and adultery. I mean, the big ones, right? Torturing animals. You wouldn't want to even associate with somebody who doesn't keep those 7. So probably everybody in your life keeps those 7, Jewish or not Jewish. What about the 606? Oh my gosh, that's a little more difficult here. So she begins the process of attempting to dissuade Ruth and Orpah. And she, unfortunately for Orpah, dissuades Orpah. Ruth? No. Okay. Verse number 8. So Vatamar Naomi l'shtecha l'teha. So Naomi says to her two daughters-in-law, Lechna, go, Shovna, return, Isha, each woman l'veitima, to the house of her mother. It means go back home. You live in palaces back in Moab, which at least before we left used to be worth a whole lot of money. So go back home to your palatial estates. And then we read this next word, even though it looks like in the Kri, sometimes we have one way where it's written one way in the Torah. It's called a Kri, the way it's read versus the way it's kiti, the way it's written. So if you look at Art Scroll, on the column there, it has a, like a little circle, and it says ya'as, and then there's a kuf with a little doohickey. That little kuf is short for kri, kara. That's the way you read it. So when someone's reading the Megillah, even though it looks like ya'aseh, we read as ya'as. The Masorah, the Masoretic tradition teaches us that's the correct pronunciation, even though it has the extra hey that it shouldn't have. Just, they do this just to confuse poor Torah readers and Shabbat. Okay, drive us nuts. Okay, so ya'as Hashem yimachem chesed, God should do with you both kindness, kasher sitem yim ha'metim v'imadi, just as you have done both with the dead and with me, Naomi says. Stop, please. So she says to them, look, just go home. You have palatial estates. You will not be marginalized living in Moab because your husbands are dead. So you'll be very, very fancy schmancy widows. You'll be from royal, regal upbringing. You'll get new husbands. You'll have new lives. You have lots to look forward to. I have nothing to offer you. And she says, in addition to that, I thank you for everything you've done for the dead and for me. So what does it mean for the dead? So the rabbis say, well, could be a reference to the fact that they chose not to collect from their husband's estates because they were entitled, Mahlon and Kilian died, they were entitled to take whatever Naomi had left because it should belong to them rightfully as the widows. And they said, and they could see Naomi's destitute situation, so they said, you know what, Naomi, you keep what's yours. We will pass on collection of our rightful ketubah, marriage document, or whatever they had back then. So they didn't go to small claims court or large claims court trying to take away Naomi. Another idea is that they actually helped pay for the funerals of Mahlon and Kilian. Such was the financial distress that poor Naomi was in after their deaths, after the death of her children. And of course, what do we call a kindness that we do for the dead? We call it a chesed shel emet, a kindness born out of truth. Because we say that we can't, once you do for somebody, if I do a kindness for you, it could always be quid pro quo. Not that I intend to do it that way, although there are individuals that do this, right? Then that becomes usury. But what if I just do a kindness for you? It could always be that you'll then, one hand rubs the other, right? What about when I do it for someone who can't pay me back because they're not in the land of the living? Now, there's something else. You could ask a question on this. You could say, well, wait a minute. Okay, let's say I do a chesed for Steve Jobs. In the back of my mind, I might think, yeah, but Steve Jobs has kind of a sizable estate, and maybe his kids are going to say, hey, that rabbi was really nice to Baruch Jobs, our dad, after his demise. And who knows, you know, I may get an iPad out of this or something, right? You never know, right? Who's to say that the family, the survivors won't give me something? So actually, it means something subtly different. You want to hear what it really means? Just as a side point. It means that, you ever heard of the expression Christian love? So Christian love, and this is not a generalization, it's used in a very specific way, is when I do something for you with the expectation I'm taking otherness from you. I'm creating a dependency, a relationship that is dependent. You will continue to me. I'll give it to you, yes, but I am not worthy of greatness of my own, but if I subsume you and make you dependent on me, then I justify my own existence. And we've all felt sometimes a reluctance to even accept a certain type of conditional kindness because we feel there's strings attached, right? And this is not a small issue, as we'll see actually one of the chapters later on. This is a huge issue. And this is what actually pushed Lot away from Abraham all those years ago. And of course, this is the full circle now because Lot is the grandfather of Ruth, whereas Boaz, who marries her, is the great-grandson of Abraham. So that issue comes full circle, as we're going to see. Now, what does that mean? So if I'm defining myself by taking something from you, and then you in exchange, what about a dead person? I can't take something from a dead person. Very simply, they're dead. So it's not an issue like the family might do this for me. I can't take from someone who's not here anymore. Therefore, whatever I do for someone who's dead has to be pure because I can't take what doesn't exist anymore. So that would be the, I know it's a little of a subtle point. I'm sorry for being a little too out there, but I hope that was something that we can relate to. Okay, let's go back inside the verse. So Naomi tells them, go back home and thank you very much, ladies, for everything you did for me and for the dead. Verse Tet, number 9. Yitena Shem Lechem, so God should give to you both, umitzena menucha, that you should find, you know, menucha, rest, tranquility. Isha beit isha, each in the home of her new husband that you will undoubtedly marry in the near future. Vatishak lahen, and what happened as a response? She, Naomi, kisses the two of them, Orpah and Ruth. Vatisena kolan vatifkena, and they lifted up their voices in bechi, in crying. Vatifkena, and they wept, they cried. And they said, no, Naomi. Verse Yud, number 10. But Tomarnala, Orpah and Ruth said to her, no, ki itach nashuv la'ameich. The word no is not there, but it's implied. It would be somewhere between the word la and ki itach. Like, it should say lo, no, because that's what they're saying to her. They're saying, no, ki itach nashuv la'ameich. We will go with you. We will return to your people. We want to come back with you. No, we're not going to leave you. So they passed number one, right? Remember, three times they're supposed to be dissuaded. Number one, Orpah even passes this test. And they say, no, we're coming back. Ah, now Naomi has to get more direct with them. So Vatomer Naomi, so Naomi says, Shov nav dinotai, go back, my daughters. And this gets a little crazy. Lama tilach na'imi, why are you coming back with me? Ha'odni banim b'me'ai? What, do I have more children in my womb? In my stomach? Vayu lachem lanashim, that they would be like potential husbands for you? Really? You think I'm pregnant, this old lady? Shavna v'natai lechna, go, my ladies, my daughters, return, go, get out of here. Ki zakanti miyot leish, I'm too old to have a man. Come on, look at me. Ki amarti. And even if I would say in my own mind, yesh li tikva, that I have, like hatikva, right? I have hope. That there's still hope for an old lady like me. That, you know what? Gamayiti halayla leish. Even tonight, if I had a man who could impregnate me, the gam yaladati vanim, and also I could give birth to sons. What? And this is verse number 13, Yud Gimel. Halahein tisaberna? Would you really wait for those young men who now are zero old, who are going to now, you have to wait like at least 18 or 20 years for them to grow up. You're going to wait for them? Ad asher yigdalu? Until they grow up? Our marriageable age? Halahenta agena, you're going to tie yourselves to them? You're going to just wait and wait and wait? And livilti yot leish, you're not going to marry anybody else for all those years? You're going to wait 20 years for my kids to grow up? Even if I had a husband, which I don't even have, I have no prospects. Oh, benotai, no, my daughters, Naomi says to Orpah and Ruth. You can understand now why Orpah's kind of grossed out here. She says, ki marli ma'od mikem, I have become very embittered. My life, look at my life, how miserable I have become. Mikem. And I'll explain what that means. Some say it means because of what you guys did by marrying my late sons, but usually it means, a simple explanation is, ki marli ma'od mikem, I am more embittered than you are. Ki yatsa, turn the page, vi yad Hashem, because God's hand has gone forth against me in retribution for my husband and for me and my sons forsaking the land of Israel. Okay, stop. Now, these last verses are a little weird, right? So what in the world is Naomi doing? She's putting a perspective on their relationship. Says, look, I understand that you're coming to Israel. Have you thought about what's going to be in Israel? Okay, let's just take stock of who we are, okay? I'm an old lady. I'm past the age where I can have a husband. Look at me. I'm all worn out and withered away from the years. I can't have any more children. And you are going to go back as a Moabitess. A Moabitess in Judah? You think you're going to get a shidduch? You think you're going to marry again? You're going to be the most disgusting people in the eyes of the people of Judah. They're xenophobic to Jews. They don't like Jews from other tribes. How do you think they're going to treat a Moabite princess who used to be married to two guys who ran away from Israel in their time of need? No one's even going to look at you. You're going to be garbage. So what are you thinking? Maybe you're thinking, oh, well, I'll go back home, and I'm the famous Naomi, and I'm going to get remarried, and I'm going to have children. So what? You're going to wait around? And they were both about 40 years old, Orpah and Ruth. So you're going to wait 20 years for the kids that I don't even have, from the husband I don't even have yet, zero prospect, no money, and those kids you can marry because you already have a relationship with me. Is that really going through your mind at this point? Could you please go back home? Thank you so much. Bye. Now, this is pretty heavy stuff, okay? But it's showing you a perspective. I mean, Naomi wants Orpah and Ruth caveat emptor, right? Let the buyer beware. She wants to make sure unequivocally that Orpah and Ruth are not under some delusion of what might or might not be in their future for them. Any comments about this? Pretty heavy stuff, right? Now, there's no law, by the way, that a rabbi or anyone of the Jewish faith has to do this to somebody who's looking to become Jewish. But there should be a reality check, right? I mean, the simplest reality check would be, why in the world are you adding 606 to the number, magic number 7, that you already can keep and go to heaven? Why in the world would you do this to yourself, right? That's like a simple way of codifying and clarifying for somebody what they're accepting. Here it's much worse, right? Because think about it. This is like, you know, this is like Jewish people, you know, in 1939 saying, well, gee, I think I'm going to go back. I don't want to live in America anymore. I'm going to go back to Germany. Really? And your prospects are looking good there, right? Really? So, I mean, it's insane. You're insane to come with me. Now, Orpah, gone. She's blown away by this. Now, it's kind of gross. The whole thing, the idea of, you know, I don't know why she gets in such graphic detail. And she could just say, look, I'm too old to get married. I'm not going to have children. But she's clearly laying it out on the line that, look, young ladies, whatever you're thinking about my relationship with you, I love you very much. But I have zero to offer you now and forever. So please go back. Because whatever the relationship between you and I means, it's not going to be something for, there's no future in Israel for you. Bye-bye. Okay? And let's look at the next verse, please. So Pasuk, Yutam. So in a response to this diatribe, I don't know what else to call it, Vatisena Kolan, so the two of them, Ruth and Orpah lift up their voices, Vatifkena Od, and they cry a lot, exceedingly so. They cried again. Vatishak Orpah lachamata, Orpah kisses her former mother-in-law. And this is a very famous phrase. Verut and Ruth, dafkaba. She clings to her. Okay, stop. You probably heard that expression. Very, I mean, in the lexicon of our Torah, Ruth, dafkaba. Those three words are like, whew, top 10 material. Ruth clings to her. Okay, let's discuss this, because it's an amazing idea. You heard an expression in English, to kiss it off, to kiss it goodbye? Probably comes from here, because that's what Orpah does. She kisses her mom, her former mom, and says, bye. And then she turns her oref. Remember, we said the word Orpah, her name means the back of the neck. The back of your neck is called your oref, right here, this little spot. So she turns away, and as we said at the end of last week, proceeds to not only leave behind Naomi and Ruth, but dedicates the rest of her life and the lives of every child she'll ever have to the destruction of everything that Naomi and Ruth hold dear. Now, this is not a small issue. The Talmud says, not only does Orpah eventually give birth to this warped human being called Goliath, three others who are descendants of Orpah all try to murder the same person. Four people try to murder David HaMelech, and each one of them, the Talmud says, is a descendant of Orpah. And we talked about how that night she makes herself into a prostitute and like sleeps with everybody under the sun. This whole Philistine guard comes along the road and she says, here we are, okay? And she gives birth to whoever, and they're like monstrous genealogy. It's horrific, okay? Now, why would she act so crazy? I mean, it's one thing to say, okay, I understand I can't come back to Israel. But then to do the 180 in such a profane way? So remember we used the analogy of the Jonestown thing? I believe it's very similar. See to Naomi, she's like kind of gross here when she's talking about her own womb and, you know, children. And I believe that this is sort of like splashing the cold water on Orpah. And Orpah's like, wakes up and says, I was in a cult of Naomi. What am I doing here, right? So what happens very often in experience when a person leaves a cult? What do they do with the rest of their lives? They dedicate the rest of their lives to destroying the cult. They become anti-cultists, right? They will go out of their way to literally save people from that cult. Now, this is an opposite of the norm, obviously. It's a metaphor only. But in the eyes and the mind of Orpah, she kind of like woke up from a bad dream of what almost could have been an alternate universe where she was going to be stupid enough to go back to Israel with Naomi, all because of this infatuation with all things Naomi and her dead husband. And then she's kind of like read the riot act very candidly, right, pointedly, right in her face from Naomi. And she wakes up and says, oh my gosh, I'm gone. And she kisses her very perfunctorily, turns around, goodbye. Never see you again for a couple generations, and you'll meet me, and I'll kill you. Don't worry, I'll get you. That was Orpah. So you see this amazing transformation. And what does Ruth do? Ruth, Dafkapa. She clings to her. Now, everyone has this beautiful vision. I believe it's been in paintings. If you will go home tonight and Google Ruth, Naomi, you will see paintings and artist renderings of like Ruth, you know, draped over the neck of, you know, Naomi. You can visualize it, right? But it's not necessarily a physical action. Clinging, cleaving. She cleaved to her. Well, what does that mean? She was absolutely 100% resolute. I'm not leaving under any circumstances. And then she's going to say in a few moments, only death is going to separate you and I. You can say whatever you want. You can spit on me. I'm not leaving. I'm staying with you. So the clinging is the heart. It's the soul. It's not a physical action. Everyone has this vision of, you know, bear hug. Okay, whether that happened or not, that's irrelevant. It's the determination, the will of Ruth. That's what clearly is going on here. Dafka, I'm clinging to you. You're not getting rid of me so easily, to say the least. Let's carry on. So that's a very, very famous verse. Now we proceed with an amazing give and take. All we know from what Naomi said, because she doesn't really say very much, all we know about what Naomi said is the response of what Ruth says to Naomi. So we can deduce from the answers or the responses what must have been the give and take in this little amazing discussion. These are among the most poetic and famous words in the whole Torah, the 24 books of the written Torah. Okay? So what I will do is I'll read it to you in the... It doesn't... You know, it's much better in the Hebrew, okay? But we'll try our best to do both, okay? So, Pasuk Tetzayin, number 16. Vatomer Rut, and Ruth says to Naomi, after she clings to her, after she cleaves to her, she says, Al tifgi'i vi. Stop, like, urging me. Now, literally, the word pogea doesn't mean urge. You know what it means? It means to, like, hit me, push me. Stop, like, come on, old woman, stop pushing me away. I'm not going anywhere. So stop already. Stop pushing me away to dissuade me. It's not going to happen. To leave you or to abandon you. That I should go back from you. I'm not returning. Because wherever you go, I will go. And wherever you sleep, wherever you lodge, I lodge. Amecha, me, your people are my people. And your God is my God. I mean, these are like, whoa. Ugh. They really touch the heart. Ba'asher tamuti amut, verse 17, Yet Zion, where you die, I will die, Ruth says to Naomi. B'sham ekever, and there I will be buried. Ko yaseh Hashem li v'cho yosif. Thus may Hashem do to me. She's swearing out of God. She's making a holy oath, a divine oath, invoking the name of God. Thus shall Hashem should do to me v'cho yosif. And even more, ki hamavet, because only death itself, yafrid b'ni v'ne. She'll separate me from you. Oh my gosh, it's beautiful. Okay, so let's talk for a second. Now, gorgeous verses, right? But it's even better. Because I believe it's two levels going on here. Now, we don't know what Naomi said. But the rabbis say crazy, crazy, convoluted things in the Talmud and the Gemara. When I say crazy, meaning they deduce from the conversation of Ruth, from these beautiful poetic words, what Naomi was saying to her. So, for example, let's go back to the beginning of the poem. So she says to her in middle of 16. She says, for wherever you go, I will go. Okay? And where you lodge, I will lodge. So wherever you go, I go. So the rabbi said, well, she was explaining to her that Shabbat, we Jews don't travel X amount of 2,000 amot, the certain amount of space we don't leave the tichum, the area of Shabbat. We're not allowed to. She says, that's not a problem. Where you go, I will go. Oh, by the way, you can't be alone with if you're a married woman or a woman, you can't be alone with a man. It's called yichud. She says, you can't lodge with a person like that. She says, that's okay. Where you lodge, I will lodge. Oh, we got to have a mezuzah on the door. So not a problem. Where you lodge, I'll lodge. If the mezuzah is good enough for you, I'll buy mezuzahs for my house. Not a problem. Okay? And then she says, your people are my people. Talking about now, you know, acceptance of God. And your God is my God. No more idolatry. Can't go to your house of idol worship anymore. She says, it's not a problem for me. And then she says, where you die, I will die, and there I will be buried. Talking about Israel now, I'll never forsake Israel. I want to be buried in Israel. Now, it's kind of ruins the poem, but it doesn't. You see, on a Talmudic level, it's clearly a give and take. What is Naomi saying to her? These are like reasons why you should not become Jewish. I'll lay them out for you. If you become Jewish, you're going to have to keep 606 more than 7. She says, not a problem. You have to do this, you have to do this, do this. And the response is the same each time. Not a problem. What does this remind you of? You know what it reminds you of? This is the source for Nasa v'Nishma. This is Sinai. Because God comes to the nations of the world and he says to the Edomites, do you guys want to be my people? You want to be the nation of Israel, the Edomites, you know, Esau's people? Yeah, we want to become the Edomites. I mean, we want to be the Jewish people. Great. God says, you want to keep my Torah? Yeah, we're there. Then they say, well, what's written in that Torah? God says, what's written in the Torah? You have to ask me? Oh, okay, fine. Edomite, thou shalt not murder. Oh my gosh, murder? I'm Esau. What do you mean? What's what I do? I'm sorry. I'm gone. It throws down and leaves the house. Okay, the Ishmaelites are up next. The B'nai Ishmael say, we're in. We want to be Jewish. God says, sure, you can be Jewish. You can be Israel. Welcome. Oh, what's written in the Torah? What's written in the Torah? You're asking what's written in the Torah? Okay, fine. Don't steal. You like that one? Don't steal? Get Neva? I'm Ishmael. What are you talking about? This is garbage. And they run out. And he does it for every nation. Now, comes to Jewish people. You guys were last, right? I'm probably stepping up. We see everyone else run out of the base vanish. We're going, geez, there's no audience here. I wonder what's going on, right? The last guy comes up. Jacob comes up, you know. What do you say, Jews? Oh, we're ready to become Israel. Really? Yeah, we're ready. I have a Torah. Okay. 613 laws. Okay. You interested in a preview? No. We'll buy the book right away. We don't want a preview. You sure? Yeah. Just kind of crazy laws. It's okay. Not a problem. Jews have to, I don't know, sleep upside down in hammocks. It's okay. Not a problem. That's Ruth. Every time Naomi's throwing these curveballs at her, she's saying, this is not a problem. It's okay. So that's the whole point. Whatever Naomi would have thrown at Ruth, Nasa v'Nishma, I'm in. Don't you understand? I'm not interested in the details. I'm interested in your heart. That's what God says at Sinai. If you have to ask what's written in it, then it's not for you. You're lost. I want your heart. And if you're not going to give me your heart and me in return, God says, I'll give you my love and protection. If that's not the relationship, it's not about love. Remember we spoke about that at the beginning, a book of love. If it's not predicated on that loving relationship between you and I, goodbye. It's not for you. So even asking what's written in it means you can't have it anymore. I mean, we all know this experience by your own children, right? Think about it for a moment. What's the most... It just diminishes the relationship when somebody says, I have something, and someone says, really, before they do it. Instead of saying, yay, I'm great, they say, well, tell me about it first. Well, what does it look like? I have a toy. Really? What exactly? They're not even looking, right? They're playing their iPad or whatever. I have something special too. I want to take you out. Really? Where are we going? Right? It's almost like it's conditional. At the point where they say, really, tell me about it, what's the response very often of a parent to a child? Gee, I was going to take you out to go get ice cream, but since you had to ask and you weren't ready to leave, I guess it's not for you, right? And we've all experienced this. That's what God was saying. I want to know. It's the heart. And Ruth says, Naomi, you can ask me anything you want. It's not a problem. Okay. At the beginning of tonight, we spoke about how Abraham and Lot had this relationship, and it blew up because Lot became a multimillionaire overnight. In the aftermath of the escape from Egypt, both Abraham and Lot became multi-billionaires, on paper anyways, like flocks and everywhere else. And Lot couldn't tolerate the relationship anymore. to the point where he was allowing his sheep and his animals to graze from lands that didn't belong to them, transgressing the law of the Torah. So when Abraham called him to count, remember what Abraham said, I see we can't live together. He says, Hiparedna me'alai. Let's separate now, please, from me. You can go, you go west, I'll go that way, left, I'll go right. And Lot looks around, and what does he see? Oh, Sodom, nice place. Let's go live in Sodom, right? Famous story. Look at the magical words of the last poetic phrase of the response of Ruth to Naomi. This is in the end of Numbers 17. Okay? Only works in the Hebrew. She says, Ki hamavet, only death itself, and there's the word, Yafrid will separate. Exact same word that Abraham threw at Lot. Hiparade, separate. Oh my gosh, this is the completion of the circle. In other words, it's not just that Lot leaves. Lot never goes back. People forget that after the destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah, yes, they're taken out alive, but they go up to a mountain. He never returns to Abraham, ever. In fact, he says to the angels, I can't go back to the mountain. I'll die. And the Rashi over there says, what is the mountain? It's Abraham. I can't be with Abraham. Compared to Abraham, I'm garbage. I'm nothing. I can't be always in the shadow of Abraham. I'd rather die than go back to Abraham. And he never goes home. Actually, he does go home at this moment. The journey from Moab back is the return of Lot that left in the form of Ruth to come back now to Abraham. And that's why the words, Rak hamavet, only death will separate you. That's what Lot should have said in the first place. Abraham, you're Abraham, I'm not going to leave you. Okay, we're having a little issue here. We'll resolve it. No, I'm gone, I'm separate. Ruth says that's never going to happen again. Death will separate us, nothing else. Next week, please God, we'll be together and we will discover the hero of the story. We've already met many heroines of the story. And we're going to meet the hero of the story, Boaz, an amazing relationship that is going to start to be between Ruth and Boaz. Shabbat shalom, everyone.